This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, the last chapter for one of the nation's most brutal, murderous gangsters, James Whitey Bulger, goes to prison for two life sentences with another 5 years thrown in for good measure.
That old bastard is finally going to be in prison. He's going to die in prison. And you know what? Today is the first day that we can finally get on the road for closure.
Also, the president nominates a top doctor from Boston to be the next Surgeon General. A big part of that job will be fixing Obamacare, which the president apologized for yesterday.
I completely get how upsetting this can be for a lot of Americans, particularly after assurances they heard from me that if they had a plan that they liked, they could keep it.
And an Indian tribe on Martha's Vineyard considers opening a casino on the island. Residents have mixed emotions.
They need a little action up there. And I know my dad would go there once in a while. And a lot of other dads would totally go down there.
All those stories and more with Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor at the Boston Globe. Hi, Dante.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And here in the studio, Jim Sturgis, Director of the Pioneer Institute. Welcome back to you, dude, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim and Dante, let's talk casinos to get started. We had a story today on Morning Edition by one of our reporters, Fred Tice. And what I found really interesting was that he talked to some Indian tribe members on the island who felt like the release of this letter this week saying that the Aquinnah Wampanoags can gamble was politically timed so that it might increase the chances of the tribal chairwoman of being reelected this weekend. There's a campaign this weekend, an election this weekend. So, Dante, I want to get your sense about whether this very complicated story could actually just be, to some degree, a political ploy going on here.
I think it's entirely possible. I'll defer to your reporter about the internal politics of the tribe. But, you know, as much fun as it might be to imagine the world's preppiest casino on Martha's Vineyard, there are plenty of reasons to think that this is not automatically going to happen. This letter that's been bruited about is only one step in an early step within what is presumably a longer process within Interior. And the Department of the Interior has gone up against states before, most notably Rhode Island, on casino-related issues and lost at the Supreme Court level. It's also noteworthy that the Aquinnah Wampanoags haven't done the level of detailed planning that the Mashpee Wampanoags have. So there's a lot of reasons here to think that this isn't, I don't want to say fully baked, but certainly isn't as far along as you would expect a full-fledged casino to be.
And there certainly seems to be wide agreement that this is going to be appealed. It could go quite high up the appellate chain. So certainly not the end of this. And as we heard in Fred's story this morning, there's a sense that, look, yes, this sounds like a big ruling, but it was basically one lawyer at one agency. So who knows how it'll actually play out. Jim, a question for you. If the casino does come to be, we've heard obviously concerns by island residents that it's going to change the whole nature of the island. Do you think if this casino was built as described, it really would have a huge impact on Martha's Vineyard and how it feels to be there and live there?
You know, this is casinos bring along a culture all their own, and I would think that anybody who would believe that the initial approval of a casino would be where it would be in, say, 25 years, I think is kidding himself or herself. You just have to take a look at the extent and the height of the various casinos that have been built around the country. I would say, just building on the point that Dante was making a second ago, I don't think it's all about an election. I think there's way too much money potentially at stake for that to be the case, and especially for, say, the Mashpee tribe in Taunton and their existing agreement with the state where they would get 21%. The state would get 21% of the revenues if they're the only casino, but they would get zero if a casino is built in the southeastern region. There's a lot of money in between 0 and 21% of the overall proceeds, and I have a feeling that people are drawn to that. So I think there's probably a lot more at stake here than that.
We should also note that at least in the case of the casino proposed for the Vineyard, initially it's basically a converted community center that would largely be blackjack, poker, and so forth. So not a big resort casino like we've seen proposed in Everett. Jim and Dante, question for both of you. This weekend, a group of casino opponents will be collecting signatures to try to put a referendum on next year's ballot to repeal the state's gambling law. Now, a few months ago, that might have seemed like a fanciful idea that law could be repealed. But given the chaos in the gaming world in Massachusetts in the past few weeks, do the two of you think that could actually happen? Could this law go away?
I think you would see an effort by people to keep it off the ballot as a matter of legal challenges, just because it is a process that has gone quite far along. But having said that, I mean, I think there was a feeling probably 6 months or a year ago that even if you weren't all of that fond of casinos, that this development was going to be kind of inevitable. And there was a feeling that, you know, definitely in places like East Boston, oh, sure, of course people are going to pass it. But I think what's happened since, obviously, makes you think that there's a lot less enthusiasm for it than was the case maybe even a year ago.
And Jim Sturgis, is it possible we will never have casinos in Massachusetts?
I would go out on a limb here and say yes. I'd say that, as Dante was saying a second ago, inevitability is gone. East Boston blew that out of the water. And I would say the second thing is that it would definitely make the ballot if it passed the legal challenges to that. So then I think anyone's bets, you know, is good as another one. So,
apt terminology.
Well, let's move on to the sentencing of convicted Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger. Yesterday, a federal judge sentenced him to two life sentences plus 5 years. He was convicted in August of participating in 11 murders, drug trafficking, racketeering, and extortion. Courts are a place for justice, not necessarily healing, of course. But Connie Leonard, the daughter of one of Bulger's many victims, said on Thursday after the sentencing that this process had been helpful.
Just to have this be recognized and have it be closed in this way was good. This is good. To watch him in that orange jumpsuit was awesome. We loved that. You know, all of us, we talked about that. He just, he looks so tiny up there. And like I said, he's a maggot. Everybody knows it. And there he's going to rot now.
Well, from a larger-than-life gangster to a small old man in an orange jumpsuit, Dante, let me come to you. What's the significance of this final chapter of this long, very painful Whitey Bulger saga?
The sentence itself was absolutely to be expected, you and everyone else in the Boston media has discussed at length. The defense that he put on was a non-defense. Mm-hmm. He seemed to be not contesting the charges against him exactly as he was playing against this fictitious gangster's code that he seemed to be trying to enforce. And the whole spectacle was not the most, it wasn't exactly an attempt by him to prove his innocence. What was interesting to me about the sentencing was the judge's statement. The person that you just had on was calling him a maggot, and talking about how small of a person he was. The judge, in a much more majestic way, said the same thing. She said, "You and others may be deluded into thinking that you represent this city, but you don't." I mean, effectively, she was saying, "Get over yourself." Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty appropriate message to send, and I think that's the final statement on this subject.
Some of the other language that came out of Judge Denise Casper's mouth: the scope, the callousness, the depravity of your crimes are almost unfathomable. So, yes, some pretty strong statements there. Jim Sturgis, what was your response to what we saw yesterday?
Well, I thought the Globe's front page with Kevin Cullen was pretty powerful, in the sense that Kevin Cullen usually writes his own column. And instead, he decided not to, and he basically took Judge Casper's words verbatim in much of it and said, "This is a really powerful statement of what this trial means to Boston." I'd say, obviously, this was a case that fascinated people in Boston around the country for probably three reasons. One was the FBI tie-in. The second one was the political connections. People always had this perception that Billy Bulger's power in part stemmed from knowledge of who his brother was. And then there was the raw animal-like violence that was perpetrated on victims with a sort of primitive pettiness. The thing that fascinated me is this, and I didn't follow it as closely as others, is this was all against a backdrop of a new Boston. Everyone talked about a new Boston. Mm-hmm. We have the convention center being sort of the locus of, where much of this took place, right? A changed neighborhood, convention center, restaurants, new buildings. And it's a bit like a Nordic saga of the Vikings perpetrating violence to the Swedes today, except we saw it all sort of truncated into one generational change. So it looks like we'd like to tell ourselves a story that this is something from our past, dark past. I would remind folks that there were stories this week of a body being severed and being burned in two different locations in Massachusetts. I'm not exactly sure that's the case.
Mm. Well, I mean, related to that, I mean, one of the big issues you mentioned, Jim, the FBI tie-in back in the 70s and 80s, they paid and protected Bulger as an informant, even provided him with C4 explosives at one point. I mean, we just had a trial that sent him away to prison. But has there been a full accounting of the official complicity in the Bulger story over the years? Dante, let me ask you that.
One thing that we've noticed both in the Bulger case and in the Tsarnaev case is that there is within law enforcement agencies and maybe especially the FBI a limit to the amount of internal accountability. There are obviously procedures for dealing with renegades, and the FBI, you even heard it yesterday, I think there was an FBI official who had said that there was a small number of people within the agency who had who had been complicit in this, and so there was a statement that did seem to minimize the agency's role, and that seems to me to be a little unfortunate, because you want to have a more satisfying accounting for what the agency did in this case.
Dante and Jim, let's turn to Obamacare. And where do we begin here? This has been, for Democrats and Republicans alike, an excruciating rollout. Yesterday, we heard President Obama address how clumsy the deployment has been, the outrage Americans have felt who have lost their substandard health plans as a result of the ACA. So here's what Obama said yesterday at the White House.
The bottom line is insurers can extend current plans that would otherwise be canceled into 2014. And Americans whose plans have been canceled can choose to re-enroll in the same kind of plan.
So superficially, good news for those who were canceled, chaos for the health insurance industry that now has to decide how to re-enroll people. Jim Sturgis, question for you. Where does the Affordable Care Act go from here? Do you consider this a major setback, or is it just a bump in a road and eventually this will be a smooth functioning law?
I think 1 year after the presidential elections, we find out that at least on one score, Mitt Romney was right. And that is that it's possible for a smaller government to actually take on some of these huge challenges when you have a very diverse population, you have very diverse cultures and business cultures and histories. But when you try to make, from the federal level, a one-size-fits-all fit the American people, it doesn't work very hard, very well. I'd say put yourself in the position of someone who has always worked hard, has paid his or her way, and all of a sudden finds that your insurance is dropped. That's a really tough pill to swallow. There are a million people in California who've seen their insurance drop. You probably see 4, 8. We don't know exactly what the upper end is, maybe about 12 million possibly would see their insurance dropped. I think the thing for me that is the only way forward for Obamacare is actually to have some people act like grown-ups in Washington, D.C., and I'd say this. There's a kind of unilateralism even to this move by the president. If you think back when the president decided to carve out an exception for people who had insurance through their businesses, there was a carve-out that was postponing some really hard conversations. That was done unilaterally. That's not in the law. The same thing is happening here. Basically, the president decided to postpone part of the implementation of the law unilaterally. You don't get to pick and choose what parts of the law you want to implement. That's not the rule of law. That's the rule of man. That's not what this country's about. So I'd say, look, it'd be really great if they could all just put their heads together and say, let's try and work on something together. I know that is wishful thinking, but I think that's actually the only way forward, because you can't do something this big without any support from the other side. And I know how hard the other side has been to work with, too, but it has to get done. Otherwise, I think it will fail.
Dante, it was just a month or so ago that the Republican Party was was sort of its reputation was looking so poor because of the end of the government shutdown. Now we have almost a role reversal. It's the Democrats hurting from this. What do you consider the long-term damage for the president and the Democratic Party from this botched rollout?
What's most striking to me about it is that they seem to have viewed the implementation of Obamacare essentially as a political problem, meaning that once they got it enacted, once they got to the point of being able to enroll people, that all of the problems and all of the political resistance would either sort of melt away or become irrelevant. But what they really fundamentally misunderstood about it, and I think this is something that has been really deeply damaging to the president's approval ratings, is the fact that they really didn't seem to anticipate, or at least the political team didn't seem to anticipate or respect, the level of logistical barriers that they would have to overcome to get this thing upright. And there were internal memos that suggested that the economic team at least thought, well, we don't really have the people in place and we don't have the muscle to put up the exchanges that we need. And the political team seems to have kind of tamped that down. But they really do still need, even now, they need people who are actually capable of building a working system. And the measures that the president is announcing about delaying certain aspects of it, and now there's talk about whether Kathleen Sebelius should go or not, it doesn't really get to the heart of the issue, which is that they still seem not to have figured out a way to execute something that they desperately need to execute.
I want to bring up one different bit of healthcare news quickly, which is President Obama's nominee to be the next Surgeon General is a local guy, Dr. Vivek Murthy, a 36-year-old attending physician at the Brigham and Harvard Medical School. This doctor was a vocal and early backer of the president's healthcare law. Clearly, advocacy of that law would be a big part of his job. Jim Sturgis, is this largely going to end up being mostly a lobbying job? Forget about encouraging Americans not to smoke and to eat healthy. Is this a lobbying position?
I certainly hope not, because I think the Surgeon General has a lot of different responsibilities that are very important besides this. And I do think that the sales job on this has to be done by the president, by especially Democrats. I think Bill Clinton, by saying, you know, you need to honor your commitment, he's opened up the floodgates on the Democratic side as well. I think the Democrats will now have a real conversation about which way they go forward. I hope that's not the Surgeon General's role.
Let's move on and talk quickly about this idea of bringing the Olympics to Boston. Last month, Governor Patrick signed a bill allowing a commission to look into the idea of bringing the 2024 Games to the city. This week, a group of business leaders and other notables, including Patriots owner Bob Kraft, former Governor Mitt Romney, builder John Fish, and former Police Commissioner Ed Davis, announced that they're on board. They met with the International Olympic Committee last week, and on Monday, here's what Commissioner Davis said about the group's motivations.
We've been through a lot over the last year, and people have recognized that. But more than that, we are a city that is a destination place, a city that's one of the best in the world. And we really have this idea that we can show that off.
So really quickly, from both of you, I'll start with you, Jim. The Olympics could cost the city billions of dollars, but it could also lead to all kinds of improvements. Is it worth the trade-offs?
Well, you know, I agree with Ed Davis on the city. It's a great city. It's a great state. And so it's a world-class place to be. Why not? But I do fear that our private institutions, while they are marvelous in terms of medical institutions, biotech, universities, I'm not so sure the state and local governments are actually capable of. And I would just highlight one thing. He talked about the city. This would have to be something, from my perspective, that would benefit the entire region. And it would build the brand of the region. Second thing is, look, it would have to have lasting impacts in terms of improving people's lives. Mm-hmm. If you make those transportation investments, they better be geared toward things we absolutely need. And the third thing is, look, anybody who's followed the World Cup or has followed the Olympics has seen all kinds of infrastructure built that was later underutilized, abandoned. We can't do that sort of thing. So I would hope as they think it through, they do things like truly think through use of dormitories as part of, you know, the Olympic Village, even if it takes additional security and that sort of thing. Don't go and build stuff that we won't use later on.
What do you think, Dante? Olympic Boston.
I agree with Jim that you need to approach it with a level of skepticism, especially because of the record of past Olympics in terms of leaving a bunch of white elephants behind them. I do think that if it's pushed forward as something not to improve Boston's self-esteem, but as something that could become an engine for infrastructure improvements and a better transportation system, I think that there's a way of doing it that actually contributes in a more sustainable way to a better city, and the bid ought to proceed along that assumption. Whether the International Olympic Committee is interested in something that, you know, primarily furthers Boston's infrastructure as opposed to something that leads to a lot of glittery new buildings for the opening ceremonies, I don't know.
Jim and Dante, as you know from our past panels, we like to end with hubbubs, those little stories that aren't going to make the front page, but maybe you like them on Facebook. They sort of catch your interest. Dante, you first. What's your hubbub this week?
Well, few areas of government regulation are as arcane and antiquated as liquor laws, but there are some major disputes brewing beneath the surface. On Beacon Hill this week, there was a committee hearing about this bill to allow craft beer makers to break away from their distributors, which you now require permission from the state. The distributors say marketing a new beer takes away investments and they think that they made, and they think the state should protect the status quo. Legislature has been really slow to make changes in this area, but if you like your high-end local beers, please keep an eye on how this turns out.
And Jim Sturgis, yours?
For those of you suffering the indignity of Christmas music 3 weeks before Thanksgiving, please know that the Boston Common Christmas, I am so sorry, the holiday tree has arrived this morning at 11 o'clock.
Shame on you.
Pre-Thanksgiving, the tree arrives.
For those of you who are Twitter maniacs, in the future you can follow the tree's journey on Twitter at Tree for Boston. I'm waiting for the app that'll allow you to actually track it on a mobile phone map. And please know that it came with a police escort all the way from Nova Scotia, and I hope that Maine and New Hampshire provide the same kind of police protection for that majestic conifer.
That was at Tree for Boston on Twitter.
Absolutely.
All right, I'll take a look at that later. And Anthony, your hubbub?
All right. Well, mine is about comedian Bill Maher, who, as we know, makes his living challenging political correctness. He can be funny, controversial. Sometimes he goes into the sort of that territory on the outskirts of decency. And so how to know when he's gone too far? How about when Anthony Weiner, the disgraced ex-congressman whose notorious selfies ended his political career, delivers an on-air smackdown? So last Friday on his program, HBO's Real Time, Maher said this about some closing thoughts about the Red Sox victory parade that actually stunned Anthony Weiner as he sat next to him. Let's listen.
They go to the place where the marathon bombing took place, and they put the World Series statue there, and they sing God Bless America, and they say Boston Strong, and they chant USA. You know, it was, again, a bad day. Three people died. That's terrible. More were maimed. That's horrible. But unfortunately, that happens every day in car accidents and everything else. I mean, your city was not leveled by Godzilla.
I know.
You know, you...
That was a nice small tune with you.
What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? A fair question from Anthony Weiner, Sasha. So let's go to your hub.
I want to mention an article that appeared in the Washington Post that has gotten a lot of people really whipped up. It's about the French Foreign Ministry, which issues warnings to citizens about which countries not to travel to. And it gets very specific in terms of cities and even streets. Before I say what they said about Boston, I want to say that we got off a little easy because they said in Baltimore, they said considered a dangerous city except downtown. Richmond, they said don't even go there on foot. About Boston, the French Foreign Ministry says this: avoid walking at night in Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury, and be wary of petty crime in Chinatown, the North End, and Fenway. As you can imagine, that has many people who live in those communities very fired up. And we can, it's a little startling. That's my hubbub. We can talk more about it later.
All right. Well, stay with us. Lots more to come. Pulitzer Prize winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us to talk about her latest book about Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive era. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.